Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. Dr. Mohler is president of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary and one of the nation's leading theologians and cultural commentators. To get online with Dr. Mohler, call toll-free nationwide, 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Now, here's your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Now that America's moonwalking, bed-sharing icon of pop culture is in Santa Maria, California, awaiting a verdict that is soon to be handed down by the court there, and we'll be watching that situation with you. And we're going to be talking about the Michael Jackson situation. It's something we have avoided until this moment because, quite frankly, I did not want to join the tidal wave of tabloid sensationalism. But now that the verdict is coming in and all America is going to be talking about it, we're going to try to reframe the question in terms of how we as Christians should think about this particular trial. Whatever the verdict may be, we'll tell you what that is as it's coming down, expected at least in just a few minutes, and what this means for American culture. This is a big development, just because of the magnitude of the news story, but also because I think it tells us a lot about where we are as a nation in terms of pop culture. First, a review of the news. An interesting turn in the Episcopal crisis. The Church of England newspaper now reports that bishops of the Episcopal Church USA will meet next month in an unprecedented conference. The issue of homosexuality, which was most recently brought to the point of crisis by the election of an openly gay bishop, may be the catalyst for what now is honestly described as a division of the church. The article opens with this: American bishops will meet for a critical summit next month to discuss ways that the Episcopal Church's assets can be divided up amongst liberals and conservatives if they are able to reach a way forward together. A group of bishops will gather in Los Angeles with options on the table, ranging from vows of continued Episcopal bonhomie to trial separation to a division and distribution of the church's assets. It goes on to say that a cross-section of liberal and conservative bishops hopes to sort out the complicated relationship between parishes and dioceses and properties. Now, what's really interesting about all this is that this report's coming from England, after all, the Church of England newspaper, about its sister church, the Episcopal Church USA. And it refers to this particular group of bishops as assigned the responsibility to consider, and that's what makes this story important, to consider what could be an eventual division of the church. There are those who say they want to avoid nasty church fights, looking at a division of assets and all the rest. Now, last week we looked at the article by Duke Divinity professor David Steinmetz, in which he said, on the issue of homosexuality, there really is no middle ground. And I expressed fundamental agreement with that article because I think it tells us something very important, and that is that our views of sexuality indicate and betray our far deeper convictions about a host of issues at the very foundation of theology and Christian belief, having to do with the nature of God and with the authority of Scripture. And so with all that in the mix, it is certainly interesting that this Episcopal crisis has reached the point that there are at least some bishops who are officially looking at whether this might lead to a division in the church. Of course, this comes just after, a few days ago, the Archbishop of Canterbury announced another international commission to look into the same questions. And in many ways, it is avoiding the obvious, which is the acknowledgement that there are two churches, at least two churches, divided over the issue of homosexuality, but at a more fundamental level, divided over issues of biblical authority and the nature of truth. And that's not only true in the Episcopal Church. It's true in many other denominations as well. I was absolutely struck by an article that appeared in the Orlando Sentinel just in the last few days. It was Saturday's newspaper. The Sentinel published a release from Religious News Service that indicated that conservative Christians are shifting toward the use of human embryos in stem cell research, even when they know this means the embryo's destruction. Now, as in so much journalism, this is personalized, and the person identified in this article is Peggy Willox, who describes herself as a conservative pro-life Christian living in Johnson City, Tennessee, identified as the heart of the Bible Belt. And she says that when she first considered the issue of embryonic stem cell research, or human embryonic research, she found it repugnant. She called it morally repulsive. She went on and she said, "I was equating it with killing a child. I thought of it as grinding up fetuses and all that, so I didn't want any part of it." But now Peggy Willox is a spokesperson on behalf of embryonic stem cell research, and that's what makes this story interesting. How did this woman come from the point of believing that this was the murder of a human being to the point that she now advocates this kind of research? Well, she says it was experience. It was her own experience of watching a friend decline, and eventually die of Parkinson's disease. The story, by the way, says that Peggy Willox has that disease herself. And so she, quote, went back to her Bible, recalled God's compassion for the living, and determined that cells in a petri dish aren't sacred because Scripture informs her that life begins in the womb, end quote. Now, this is something that I think is accurate, by the way, in terms of the observation of a trend. I think that the newspaper is onto something and is honestly reporting it, and considerable insight in this article. I think there is a shift. I think I can discern the shift. I can hear it in conversation. I can detect it in news reports. I can sense it out there among conservative Christians. There is fatigue in defending the dignity of human life at every level, and there is the cultural pressure of those who are pushing for embryonic stem cell research and promising all kinds of cures and all the rest. Now, we must share the hope that cures and treatments for these ominous diseases will be found. But the question is, at what cost? Now, the issue of biblical interpretation, we talked about it on homosexuality. Here we encounter it again in human embryonic stem cell research. We're told that this woman, quote, went back to her Bible, recalled God's compassion for the living, and determined that cells in a petri dish aren't sacred because Scripture informs her that life begins in the womb, end quote. Now, she gave no particular background in terms of this Bible study and what she found or what text she consulted. But the bottom line is this. If you just extend her logic, that means that no extrauterine prenatal life is worthy of protection. And that's going to cover a lot. That's going to cover a lot because medical technology is right now pressing the boundaries of what can happen outside the womb. And so we're not only talking about a clump of cells, as she would describe it, in a petri dish. We could be talking about far, far more. Let's go back to the fact that there is no bright red line that God has given us that says at some point along the line of embryonic progression and development up to the point of the birth of a human baby, there is life on one side and no human life on the other. There's human status on one side and no human dignity on the other. To the contrary, the Bible just assumes that at the very moment of conception, when those two cells come together and God says, let there be life, what God forms is thus fully deserving of our protection, and we are obligated to respect its inherent human dignity. We'll be following this. By the way, the Orlando Sentinel story cited a report from the Pew Center for the People and the Press that is documenting a similar trend, and we'll be watching the research with you. Meanwhile, from Great Britain, another report that makes you scratch your head and wonder if you could really be talking about sane people here. The British government Home Office is recommending that children should be targeted as potential criminals from the age of 3. Preschoolers. Some of them aren't even potty trained, and they're going to be booked. They're going to be identified as being on a criminal trajectory. It goes on and says, it says they can be singled out by their bullying behavior in nursery school or by a history of criminality in their immediate family. Now, I can hardly believe that in the year 2005, I'm reading this as a lead from the story in the illustrious and respected Times of London. It goes on and says that this Home Office report in Great Britain proposes parenting classes and, in the worst cases, putting more children who are not under control into intensive foster care instead of care homes. Nursery staff will be trained to spot children at risk of growing up to be criminals. I'm going to skip down. You need to hear this. Children who are not under control by the age of 3 were 4 times as likely to be convicted of a violent offense, it warned. This is the report. It adds getting schools to tackle bullying, exclusions, and truancy effectively is key to diverting more adolescents from crime. Wow. 3-year-old criminals. You know, there is no doubt that some children are born into an environment that is more given to the development of criminal behavior. There are some children you can spot in the nursery school. You can spot them in their home. You can spot them on the playground, in the sandbox, as demonstrating willfulness and a very strong sense of responsibility before the state would have to step in. By the way, this same report calls for other children to be cared for under state control from the time that they would wake up until 6 o'clock in the evening with after-school clubs and all the rest. And what we see here is a further marginalization of the family. Well, while we're on this politically incorrect territory, we might as well return to the issue of daycare. Psychology Today has published a fascinating news story, and the fact that it's in Psychology Today is what makes all the difference. It says this, the raging debates around maternal guilt, work-family balance, money, and child-rearing often drown out scientific insights into the developmental impact of daycare. But the latest findings from a huge long-term government study are worrisome. They show that kids who spend long hours in daycare have behavior problems that persist well into elementary school. The story quotes a researcher in this area, Jay Belsky, who argues that developmental psychologists are sweeping all of this information under the rug. He goes on to say that the field of developmental psychology is monopolized by women with what he calls a liberal progressive feminist bias. Their concern is not to make mothers feel bad, he says, rather than to tell mothers the truth. Now, folks, when Psychology Today, which is hardly a magazine of the religious right, starts writing in these terms, something is going on. Something's going on in Santa Maria, California right now, and we'll be back to talk about it. From Chattanooga, Tennessee, this is the Albert Mohler Program. He's a law professor, political analyst, talk show host on Salem Network, and also one of America's most influential bloggers. Now he is our guide to the entire blogosphere. Hugh Hewitt's our guest today, the author of Blog Understanding the Information Reformation. He's also a good friend. Hugh, we're thankful you came on the program today.
Dr. Mohler, great to be here. Thanks for having me, and thanks for your kind words about blog.
Well, listen, I think it is the indispensable guide for understanding what in the world's happening in this information revolution. Of course, you call it a reformation. I like that. We're going to get to that in just a minute, but first of all, we better tell some people what a blog is and, frankly, why they matter.
Sure. A weblog is an individual site run by one, two, most three or four people on which they post their views and news of the day, and they link to those sources. They are sort of cyber newspapers run as in the old days of the early republic by a handful of people, but using the Internet to publish. In 1999, there were two dozen of them. Today, there are more than 7 million of them. And some estimates have it at 40,000 new blogs being created every single day.
Well, Hugh, who in the world's reading these things?
Well, the traffic is enormous. 27% of online users, 27% of the people who use the Internet in January, also consulted one or more blogs. Now, some blogs are huge, like Glenn Reynolds' Instapundit, which gets more than 250,000 people many days, and others get 5, 6, 1, 2, 3 people. But they all get some traffic, and they all exist, and they all influence opinion, and collectively it's dynamic.
Well, the dynamic you really indicate here is the fact that the whole news business, the way we convey and analyze information, has now been democratized. I mean, frankly, you have a new democracy of information because, as you're arguing, the mainstream media have kind of lost control of the ability to contain and bury stories.
They have. The gatekeepers have no more gates, and we no longer have to persuade someone to be able to persuade someone. I know the frustration I used to have when I'd send in an op-ed to the L.A. Times or another big newspaper and get it back saying, thank you, no thank you, it doesn't fit our pages. Well, now all I have to do is go over to HughHewitt.com and write what I want, and if I have an audience and I get 30,000 to 40,000 people a day coming there, they'll come and listen and read and think and accept or reject based upon what I have to offer and the arguments I craft, not whether or not some opinion page editor thinks it's worthy of their attention.
Well, let's get down to the fact that the blogs have actually changed the way the news, the mainstream media, have to deal with the news. I mean, after all, it was the bloggers who forced the story about Trent Lott, the story about Howell Raines, the New York Times, the story about Dan Rather and Rathergate, and now, just over the weekend, Ethan Jordan and CNN. And, Hugh, I think you had a hand in that.
Well, we did. I'm very pleased with the fact I did. There were a number of bloggers involved, though, including the Powerline blog, Instapundit. Michelle Malkin did a tremendous amount of work on this. Ed Morrissey of Captain's Quarters. And it all goes down to the fact that when Ethan Jordan went to Davos, Switzerland on January 27th and accused the military of targeting journalists, he was repeating an accusation he had made in November of last year in which he said 8 to 10 journalists had been killed by the American military and that the American military was torturing journalists. Mainstream media did not care about this, but there was a blogger in Davos, Ronnie Abovitz, who posted an account of it, and that account made it to National Review's Jim Garrity, and then I picked up on it, broadcast about it. And by the a week ago, I was able to go on Chris Matthews' show and announce to their surprise that Ethan Jordan was in trouble. They'd never heard of it. And yet, within another week, Ethan Jordan was obliged to quit because information travels fast, and true information has a devastating impact when people slander the American military. He did. He resigned as a result, and the blogosphere actually ended up beginning and ending a story even before some papers, like the Los Angeles Times, had even mentioned it, Al.
Yeah, but you really forced the issue. That's what I appreciate. And let's go back to Rathergate for just a few moments. In your book, which really reads like a thriller in some sections because you recount how these events came to pass and how bloggers really got on a story and forced the mainstream media to pay attention, Dan Rather's indefensible act in putting forth, and let's broaden this to CBS as a network, their indefensible act in putting forth these obviously fraudulent memos was really brought to light when bloggers started saying, hey, that looks like modern word processing technology, and basically forced the mainstream media to take a look at it.
That's right. It began on the Free Republic with one poster who said, that looks like a forgery to me. Then the Powerline bloggers, who are three very successful lawyers, very well-trained, all went to Dartmouth, two went to Harvard Law School, one went to Stanford Law School. They combined to begin to elicit from their audience, which is vast. They get 100,000 people coming there every day. What do you think, and does anyone have any professional opinions to provide us? And there are lots of experts on everything out there, as we all are expert in something. And they came forward with the information that quickly developed into a conclusive case that they had been forged. Then it spread from places like Little Green Footballs. Many of the bloggers have very funny names, but very serious agendas and very focused approaches and very skilled abilities when it comes to investigation. Rather, never repudiated the documents, but the rest of the world did. And before long, it was obvious they had been forged. It was obvious it was a hit piece on George W. Bush, and it failed. I think it probably helped him secure the presidential reelection that was his in November.
Yeah, one of the arguments being made by some who observe the blogosphere is that it helps conservatives because the conservative sites help to distribute the information conservatives need, and the liberal sites tend to accidentally do the same thing.
Well, I think that all of new media, because old media was so dominated by the left, whenever there's anything that is dominated by one power, if equality and access or any kind of change occurs, it's got to help the minority power, the faction. Since elite media is so far to the left, Alan, you know this.
Absolutely.
Any kind of opening for truth, any kind of opening for balance, inevitably helps the center-right in this country far more than it helps the center-left. But I am curious if you think the analogy to Reformation makes sense, because your church history command is so absolute. I'm a little bit nervous asking that question, but I'll be curious to hear what you say.
No, listen, that's right where I was headed with my next question, because I found it fascinating that you used the word Reformation, and I really appreciate the way that you demonstrate that Johannes Gutenberg's invention of the movable type is providentially what allowed the writings of Martin Luther to be distributed all over Europe with the Catholic gatekeepers unable to prevent it. And that, I think, is the best metaphor I could think of for the emergence of the blog.
That's what struck me as being so persuasive. The Vatican and the Pope in the early 1500s are sitting there unaware that on their watch has developed a new technology and a new voice that would proliferate quickly, not just dissenting opinion, but also a text of Scripture in German that would allow people to decide for themselves what they meant by any particular passage, and which would allow the rapid dissemination of that new text. They were stunned that their monopoly had been shattered. They reacted by attempting to suppress it, then they attempted to bargain with it, and then eventually they were just, the Counter-Reformation came along, and that wasn't bad for everyone concerned.
Well, when you use the word Reformation, you raise a host of issues, and I appreciate the fact that you not only date the Reformation and point the mass communications aspect of it, but you actually get down to what the Reformation was about. So as your theologian friend, I want to say thank you.
Well, I hope the history is good. I had some help. I went and found some good theologian, good church historians to make sure I didn't miss anything. But it's a sketchy, quick couple of
it's
chapters
good stuff.
In there. But nevertheless, the argument holds true that the old media, the big three networks, the big newspapers, were very much like the Vatican when the Vatican was challenged by Luther. They are reacting even today as the Vatican reacted to Luther then. Slow, unsure of themselves, very, very dyspeptic, and very, very threatened.
Well, that's the first time I think the word dyspeptic has been used on this program in a long time. But that's one of the things I appreciate about Hugh Hewitt, a very learned and articulate man who, frankly, is preparing right now for his own nationally broadcast radio program on the Salem Radio Network. It's coming up at 6 o'clock, so when we finish here, you need to go right over there, and then you need to go buy Blog. Published by Nelson Publishers, it is the indispensable guide to the Internet Revolution, the Information Reformation, and the blogosphere. Hugh, thank you so much for giving us some time this afternoon.
Thank you, Al. Always a pleasure.
Well, folks, we're going to be talking about what the blogosphere means to you. I want to tell you, just as a Christian theologian, I think one of the things that it means to me is that that information is now immediately and almost universally accessible to anyone who can get to the computer. That's an amazing thing just with the Great Commission in mind. I want to know about your adventures in the blogosphere. Give me a call, 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. From the radiosphere about the blogosphere, I'm Albert Moeller.
listening to the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. To get online, call toll-free 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Or go to www.albertmohler.com. Here again is your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Welcome back to the Albert Mohler Program. The topic today is the blogosphere. It was great to have my friend Hugh Hewitt as our guest in the second segment. He's my colleague on the editorial board for Salem Broadcasting, and he really is about the best guide to the blogosphere that I know. He was one of the first to really jump on it, and of course you've seen his name associated with some of the big news stories related to the blogosphere, from Dan Rather to Eason Jordan, CNN, and all the rest. But, you know, a lot of the blogs don't get that kind of media attention, but they still have a lot of influence and impact. Some of the names, Instapundit, Powerline, The Daily Kos, by the way, that's one from the far left, they're joined by explicitly Christian weblogs, such as a very fine daily updated weblog at ChristianityToday.com, where you'll find just all kinds of news of interest to the Christian community. And I give a lot of my time, 5 days a week, Monday through Friday, to a major essay published in a weblog format at crosswalk.com, also found at Albert Mohler, MOHLER.com. And I should say Truth in Advertising as a way of disclosure here, that Hugh Hewitt was very nice to mention my columns in his book a few times, and that was nice too. But I want to know where you go in the blogosphere. What have you found to be helpful, interesting? Why? Where do you go? And what do you find there? The phone number, 877-893-8255, 877-893-TALK. You know, as Christians looking at this, we should see an opportunity, an incredible opportunity. First, there were none. Then were about a dozen in 1999, 4 million last year, and already this year, 7 million blogs out there. As Hugh said, maybe 40,000 new blogs a day. There's an opportunity for a lot of Christian confrontation in there, for a lot of Christian worldview teaching. There's an opportunity to get a lot out. You know, one of the things that Hugh was talking about is how the mainstream media has had to take account of the blogs. But you know what? So are the rulers of nations like China and Cuba, who would like to keep the Christian gospel out. Because the internet is this giant way of conveying information. It's not only a superhighway, it's like an ocean. And anyone that can tap right into that ocean has access to an enormous world and wealth of information. And, of course, this means that the powers that be simply don't have the power they once had. You know, years ago, you could talk about the media giants, you could talk about the three networks, and then you could see the explosion into cable news and all those variants. Just a few years ago, there were daily newspapers that basically had control over everything just in locales, cities, communities, villages. But now you have USA Today, a national newspaper. Beyond that, you have the ability of anyone, any place through the internet to read almost any paper at any time. And this changes everything. It has changed world politics, and it will change the way we address the world as Christians as well, because it gives us an enormous tool in order that we could reach people. Give me a call, 877-893-8255, 877-893-TALK. Where do you go in the blogosphere? What do you read? What would you recommend that other intelligent Christians should take a look at? You need to share that, because this is where the traffic is moving in the information superhighway. This is where an awful lot of what's happening is first becoming apparent. I mean, after all, the blogs are almost instantly updatable. A news story can all of a sudden emerge, and I love Hugh's expression, a blog swarm. That's what happens when all of a sudden bloggers begin to talk about one issue. It happened with Dan Rather. Everyone started looking at the document. It did look like it came off a word processor. And then someone came up with the fact that no such technology existed in 1972. It would be impossible. And they started tracking this thing down, and then they began connecting the dots. And before you knew it, Dan Rather was, well, they called it retiring from CBS. But in reality, his journalistic credibility was in tatters. Eason Jordan had to resign just last Friday as the news chief of CNN because he was caught in comments he made at Davos, Switzerland. And as Hugh said, it wasn't just that he'd made those comments. It's that bloggers were able to substantiate and prove he had made similar comments months previous. So it wasn't like he misspoke. He was making a serious argument all over again. This whole world of the internet weblog, or the blogosphere, as it is now known, is changing the field of politics. There are those who are arguing that Howard Dean's election as chairman of the Democratic National Committee is entirely due to the fact that the bloggers from the left went after all of his competitors, leaving The former Vermont governor is the only candidate for the leadership of that very crucial political party. It'll be interesting to see what that means. But from the left, it is clear that the bloggers on the liberal side are able to knock off those who they think are just insufficiently liberal. And, of course, there are a lot of conservative watchdogs out there as well. You know, the interesting thing about blogs is that they don't disappear. They just get archived on the Internet. You can go back and find something, prove what someone said, find what someone wrote. It's a completely new world. What's your place in it? Where do you go? What have you found? The number 877-893-8255, 877-893-TALK. I'm Albert Mohler. Welcome back to the Albert Mohler Program. We're talking about the blogosphere, this information revolution that is literally changing the way news is disseminated, analyzed, communicated, and then catapulted into the national arena. Because what is now happening is that the bloggers can swarm around an issue, and within 24 hours, you're hearing about it on cable television, you're reading about it in the newspapers, no one can deny it, no one can avoid it, they simply have to face it, and the mainstream media have discovered there is a new set of rules. And that's altogether good for those of us who love the truth and believe in an exchange of ideas and getting the truth out. I want to know what you think about the blogosphere, where you go, what you see, what you read, and what you would recommend. Give me a call, 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. We're going to go to Aaron, listening on WFIA Radio. Aaron, welcome.
Good evening, Dr. Mohler. How are you this evening?
I'm doing great. Glad to hear from you.
Hey, I called because you were asking what Christian-based blogs people go to out there. I myself am a blogger here in Louisville and list a number of them on my site, but probably one of the most frequently attended sites that I go to is markdroberts.com.
Yeah, pastor of the Irvine Presbyterian Church in California. We've been actually in the media together at times. Mark's a very, very faithful pastor and an ardent blogger.
Exactly. And I remember when you and Pastor Roberts actually, we're on the Hugh Hewitt Show together talking about the mainstream media's approach to Christianity during the Christmas season.
Yeah, that's right. And since then, I've been pretty familiar with Mark's site. And by the way, that's markdroberts. Is it com or org?
I believe it's .com.
All right. But we're going to put up a set of links after this program so that you can find some of these places. Aaron, how long have you been blogging?
I've been blogging for about 6 months now and was really surprised at how quickly my site grew in readership, and that was primarily because it was recognized by Hugh Hewitt. He started doing a blog of the month section on his site, and for whatever reason he found my site and put it up there last October, and I've just been having all kinds of traffic since.
Well, I bet. But, Aaron, tell us how we can find your weblog.
Mine is gotdesign, that's gotdesign.blogspot.com.
Well, we appreciate you you've given us a call today, Aaron. I'm going to put that up. Let me ask you, would you recommend to fellow believers that they ought to, first of all, check out the blogs, and secondly, would you recommend that they ought to consider blogging themselves?
Oh, definitely. This is a wonderful way to put out your Christian witness. It's also a good way to develop what I would call a virtual community of fellow believers that you can go out and, see what other believers are saying on the web. And, if you agree or disagree, you can post comments to that effect. And, you can start very intellectually stimulating conversations about your beliefs on the web.
Aaron, thanks so much for your call, and we'll be glad to refer people to your weblog as well and put up a link, and we wouldn't have known about it had you not called here and had not Hugh Hewitt given it some attention. You know, folks, we are really, really witnessing a revolution here. Let me tell you, when I came to Southern Seminary as president in 1993, we did not have a web page. We did not have an Internet website, and no one even knew what one was. I can remember the first time I heard about a home page. And that was before almost anyone had one or had gone to one. And we've tried to stay on the forefront of this information revolution. The Internet is now more or less the most important way a lot of people get to meet us, get to exchange information. Just think of what this does. This brings information right to your computer screen. Of course, there are bad things that come along with that. That's why we've talked about Internet pornography and chat rooms and all the rest. But don't discount the good things that have come by the Internet, and especially now with weblogs. I read weblogs on the other side, too. That is, I look at sites like the Daily Kos and others because I want to find out what the liberals are talking about. I want to find out what anti-Christian weblogs are talking about. I want to know what's going on out there in the world, and the weblogs are a shorthand. I guess that may be the best way to look at it. They're a shorthand. You can quickly find out what's going on. You can read little summaries, and if you want to read the whole article with the links, you can go right there. The next thing you know, you've already been given a distilled summary. Now you can read the heart of the entire article if that's what you're looking for. I love what's happening with making information more democratically accessible. I like that, first of all, as a Christian, because this means that the gatekeepers that would, for the secular world, just want to keep Christianity out, they're going to be unable to do that, because all you have to do is do a quick Google search, go on the web, all you have to do is look left or right, up or down, and you're going to find yourself confronted with somebody who's going to be making a serious Christian argument out there. That's one of the as many bad things as there are on the Internet. Let's be thankful for how much is out there. Do you realize that right now there are 35 different translations of the Bible accessible just on one site? That's an incredible thing. People from many different languages can go, even if they can't buy a Bible, or they can't get their hands on a Bible. They may not be able to get to a library, which will be forbidden even to have a Bible. But if they can get to an Internet, you just can't block all these sites. You know, that's one of the realities with spam, by the way, those unwanted notices you get in your email box, and they irritate all of us, and I'm thankful it's been made a crime. I just hope there's some people that sit behind bars for invading our privacy and inboxes with all that spam. But you know what? The reason that spam gets through is because the Internet has so many different ways of communicating information, so many different channels through which it can go, and that's a two-edged sword. That also means that repressive autocratic regimes that would want to keep out and block websites can't keep up with the multiplicity of websites that could be sending the same information. And so that two-edged sword can be used for a gospel purpose as well. We're living in an incredible time. We now have access to information that previous generations could never have imagined. Hugh Hewitt pointed to the Reformation of the 16th century as the model for understanding the transformation of our times. He points out that when Gutenberg invented the movable type press, the cost of producing a book fell 400-fold immediately. 400-fold. A book that cost $400 one day cost a dollar the next. People who could not afford even to look at a book could now have a library in their homes. That's an incredible revolution, and one that we should not misunderstand, because it is the analogy to where we are right now. P.T. Barnum once said not to pick a fight with the press, because he said you ought not to pick a fight with people who buy ink by the barrel. Now you don't even have to buy the ink. All you have to do is have access to a keyboard, access to an Internet site, and the next thing you know, the entire world could have access to what you're writing. There's an awful lot of nonsense out there. There are an awful lot of thoughts that never should see the light of day. There are some evil things out there, but there is some incredibly important information. There is information out there that subverts the powers that be, and there's some gospel information that subverts even an entire worldwide conspiracy to deny the truth, to suppress the truth in unrighteousness. As Christians, we need to be aware of the times, the perils, and the opportunities. And I'll be back with some final thoughts about that. This is the Albert Mueller Program. Into the blogosphere we go. That's what's going to be required of us if we're going to be informed in this age and understand what's going on in this media revolution, or reformation, as Hugh Hewitt calls it. It's a big deal, and it's only going to get bigger. 40,000 new blogs a day. That should tell you a whole lot. Finally, we got a caller in Louisville, Kentucky, Matt, listening on WFIA. Matt, what do you think about all this?
Oh, this is great. I really appreciate Hugh and his work with blogging, and Dr. Mueller, I appreciate your commentary. I do have a question for both of you gentlemen, and my question is, a lot has been made about journalistic accountability for the secular arena in the blogosphere, but what do we do about those of us who are Christians who are trying to have a presence with our blogs? What can we do for the sake of biblical accountability and theological accountability. What structures need to be in place so that not just anyone can spout off, you know, something that might not be biblical?
Yeah, you know, Matt, my first thought is that I think the Internet has got pretty much to be self-policing. And this is where I think Christian bloggers should read each other's stuff and jump on each other if you get outside of orthodoxy. In other words, if someone makes a mistake, we need to call them on it. And I see some of that happening. I have to tell you, I think there's some good stuff happening there. Matt, do you have any specific proposal?
Just a lot of dialogue and a lot of comments on people's blogs. Keep people on their toes and keep me on my toes, and everyone that you know who blogs, keep us on our toes.
That's right. Matt, do you have a blog?
I do.
Tell us about it.
It's matthewhall.net, and as a seminarian, it's just a lot of the stuff that I'm working and thinking through, and it's very eclectic. So.
Yeah, well, Matt, I thought this might be you. I've seen your site, and I'd recommend that people go to it. So, you know, good work, and I appreciate the fact you put so much time into kind of laying it all out there for the world to see. And good stuff there, Matt. Appreciate your call today as well.
Thanks, Dr. Mueller.
The need for theological accountability is a good place for us to conclude here, because it is a reminder to us all that we need to be careful consumers of information. Especially as Christians, we have to understand that we are to pursue the good, the beautiful, and the true, whatsoever things are pure, even on the Internet. And as we are looking at claims made, at stories told, at points argued on the Internet, we need to test everything by Scripture. That is the New Testament model. Test it by Scripture. And we need a community of Christian Internet bloggers out there who will hold each other accountable. When we see something written in error, we need to go after it in the spirit of Christian love, but with the determination of Christian truth, we need to call it as it is. And you know what? The darkness needs to fear the light. The light never needs to fear the darkness. The light will win every single time. Mao said, "Let a thousand flowers bloom." Well, that was nonsense, but let's let thousands of bloggers blog. And let's make sure we're there as Christians to get the truth out. I'll be back tomorrow for Ask Anything Wednesday. Get ready with your call. I'll meet you there.
Thanks for listening, and be sure to visit our website, www.albertmoeller.com. You'll find archives of past shows, Dr. Mueller's daily crosswalk commentary, and other important resources. You can also email your questions and comments. That's www.albertmoeller.com. Be sure to join us next time for the Albert Mueller Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter.